background to our business, for those of you who don't know, and then talk about nickel price, which I guess is one of the reasons why Tom asked me here, which is actually not looking that flash at the moment, so we have a bit of a discussion about that. The currency, which has gone the wrong way for us as well, costs, which are up, and people, our most valuable asset, and how we hang on to them, and then hopefully put all that into a conclusion. Our business, we're a nickel miner. We operate in Western Australia. We set the business up in 2001, the day after the Twin Towers came down. It was a 20-cent float, and the first trade was 14 cents. So there's a fair few unhappy punters out there at the time. And our market cap was about $12 million. And we've grown that into a business now with over 600 people. Last year we made a profit of over $80 million. This year about $60 million. We've got no debt, about $120 million in cash, and two operating assets which are growing day by day. And the vision is to create a major mining house. So it'd be nice to get as big as Alcoa one day, but got to walk before you can run. But really, it's been all about the nickel price, and it's been all about the people that have created the business for us. Just quickly about our two businesses, just so I can give you a bit of a flavour. As I said, two Western Australian assets. The Savannah project, which used to be called the Sally Millay project. It's just north of Halls Creek, and also the Lanfranchi project, which is just south of Kambalda. Both in Western Australia, nice place to do business. That's a photograph of our operations up in the Kimberley. We have our own concentrator up there. We built that about 4 years ago at about $65 million to build it. Today it probably cost you about $265 million. And we started off with a four-year mine life, and we've got still about another 6 years to go, and that was about 6 years ago. So it's done very well for us. It's an underground mine. We crush and produce concentrate and then ship that to China. And as Alan said, China is very important to the business in Western Australia. Half of our concentrate, all the concentrate from the Kimberley goes to Jingshuan in China, biggest nickel producer in China. And we produce about 8,000 tonnes of nickel plus copper and cobalt. And so that's about 1% of the world's nickel production, which is pretty small, but very valuable. The other operation is up in Kambalda. That's just a sort of an idea of what it looks like from underground. This was a Western mining asset, which we bought about 4 years ago for about $26 million. We're 75% owner and operator. Interestingly, the stamp duty we paid on this acquisition was more than what we paid for the Sally Millay project. So talk about a sort of a struggle to get over the line just on the costs associated with buying assets in any market is always tough, but it's even tougher when you've got to pay 5.5% to someone and it doesn't do anything for your business. That's what I'm saying, I guess. This is an underground operation. We produce ore and we ship it to BHP, the Nickel West concentrator in Kambalda. They do all the work for us, pay us some money, and we've got about 12,000 tonnes of production coming out of there this year. That's the history of the business since we started producing in 2004. You can see there that the ramp-up of production has been pretty good. 4,000 tonnes in 2004, up to 15,000 tonnes last year. And next year we're targeting over 20,000 tonnes. On the right-hand side, you can see our profit. We went from not making any money 4 years ago to $88 million last year and about $60 million in profit for 07-08. And that was with the nickel price had come off and our production had gone up. So we had a pretty good year, notwithstanding the markets. The bad news now, share price. It was good for a while and then that fell off the perch. And I guess most small cap mining companies have been through this in the last 6 months or even less. And it's frustrating, but it does sort of, I guess, give a bit of a flavour for where we're at the moment. We're an ASX 200 company, sort of bottom 100, I guess, of the 200. And we have really suffered from a fall in the nickel price, but also a sort of a general malaise of the markets, which we're all aware of. And we all watch what our super funds are doing at the moment. And I guess most of our super funds have got graphs like that as well, which is not flash. But it just does give you a bit of a feel. And, of course, most of our people that work for us, we've got 300 direct employees. Most of them own shares in the company. And most of those shares have been worth a lot more than they are today. So there's a few glum faces around there. But they've still got their job and they're still enjoying working for us. And it's about onwards and upwards. So talking about the challenges that face our business, and I guess that's the reason I've been asked to speak today, there are four things that I can really see: nickel price, currency, costs, and people. And it's obviously managing all of those things and making sure you've got a business which generates money and has a longevity. First of all, nickel prices, and that graph just looks like our share price graph, unfortunately, but there are some reasons for that, and it was fantastic. I was sitting in I can remember this very clearly, our chairman, who's 73 years of age, I think he's been in the nickel industry for something like 45 years. In September of last year, he sat in a board meeting and said, nickel's going to 60,000, sure as eggs. And sure enough, it's gone to 18,000 almost since he said it. So we have been on a real roller coaster in the last few years. I mean, we set the business up in 2001, as I said. We financed the project in 2003. We had to do some hedging to get our debt away. We borrowed about $60 million. And the hedging book at one stage was $150 million out of the money. So if we'd shut the business down, we would have had to write a cheque out to the bank for $150 million. And at about the same time, as and that was when the nickel price went to 50,000. And just before that, one of our major bits of gear cracked and we were out of business for about 8 weeks, at about the same time as we had the opening of the mine. So that was always a bit tough. But fundamentally, nickel is a fantastic commodity. It's 70% of the world's nickel goes into making stainless steel, which is a quality product. And stainless steel demand has grown compound at about 5% since about 1970. So it's a wonderful product. It's got a high-end use requirement for quality products, for capital items, and the Chinese just haven't been able to get enough of stainless steel. But when the price goes to $60,000 or $55,000, the main input, about 8% of most 300 series stainless, which is the main stainless that people buy, is nickel. 18% chrome, 8% nickel. And when it gets to 50,000, people don't like that, so they look for substitution and they look at anything else they can do that doesn't use nickel. And we have suffered badly from that substitution. And the problem is once people design out of stainless with nickel in it, it's often hard for them to get back into it again. And so we are definitely suffering from a business that's almost been too good. And now we've got to put up with a business which going forward isn't going to be as good. This is a little bit of a busy chart, but it's very important. We get a lot of information from Macquarie Bank because they have a gentleman there called Jim Lennon who seems to eat, sleep and dream nickel. And I'd hate to be inside his head because it must just be one huge Excel spreadsheet just churning over numbers all night. I don't know how he could be possibly married to the man because he'd just be talking nickel all the time. But basically, it's nickel price is down, but it's not out. I think that's the major important thing. And just going through some of the points you raised there, as I mentioned, nickel, stainless steel, you've got to look at the stainless steel business, you've got to look at nickel. The prices have fallen sharply. There's been an added problem that you've had actually a product that hasn't been in the market before called pig iron nickel, and I think most of you in the room probably would have heard of this, but this is basically laterite, low-grade material that comes out of the Indonesia, New Caledonia, and gets shipped up to China to these old blast furnaces. Very rudimentary, crude operation, but does produce a low-quality, effectively ferro-nickel, which the stainless steel mills have been buying in great quantity because it's been cheaper than buying nickel. And this went from a zero market about 3 years ago to over 120,000 tonnes last year. And it really was one of these swing producers that's come in and completely stuffed up our business, unfortunately. And what obviously everyone wants to know now is what is their cost of production, because the nickel price has come down to under $20,000 and everybody said that these guys were actually producing nickel at $12 to $14 or $25 to $30,000, so they should be out of business. But as we all know, that doesn't happen. Doesn't mean, if you lose money, you can still keep going. We've also found that their cost of production actually isn't as high as that, and they've changed the way they do their business, and there's a lot of other things in the background. So everyone's madly running around now trying to find out what these guys really cost to produce their nickel. It's here to stay. It may not be 120,000 tonnes, but it's something we have to get used to. And these next generation guys, instead of being $12 to $15 a pound, may well be $5 to $6 a pound, which is still above the current price. So we've got some work to do to understand that business and to really make sure that we're not uncompetitive at those sort of prices. Their costs are rising. Their inputs, obviously, are coke, and obviously they have to ship the material in from overseas, so they have a freight component as well. But fundamentally, they've managed to look at their costs as well and get them down as the nickel price has been dropping. There has been, I believe, or there will be a shift back towards some of what we call the austenitic stainless steels, which is the ones that contain more nickel. So I think you'll see that as the price comes down, but it's not quick. And then on the other side, of course, you've got supply. And supply, everyone always says in high nickel price, oh, we're going to bring a new project on, oh, we're going to do 50,000 tonnes a year, and obviously that doesn't always happen. Ramp-ups are slower. We said we'd produce 20,000 tonnes 3 years ago. It's taken us 3 years to get there. It's always harder than you think. It takes longer, and it's always one of those sort of things in our business where you have to always be sort of, a little bit conservative about your forecast because you tend to sort of always deliver on the lower side of that. But that obviously means it's good because it means supply and demand is probably going to be fairly tightly balanced going forward for at least the next few years, we hope. And contrary to what my friend Jim says there, where he's got nickel going back to $6 a pound in 2012 with a world market which is almost in balance. 80,000 tonnes can almost disappear inside of 2 or 3 weeks with a gas problem or a smelter shutdown or something. So you really have to be aware of those sort of supply-demand balances. And I think, personally, $50,000 is a long way from here. We may not see it again in the short to medium term. But certainly, prices, we have to get used to lower prices. But fundamentally, nickel, stainless steel, there's always a need for it. If it keeps growing at 5% compound, then there'll always be a demand for nickel. And what we just have to do, as I said, is manage in a lower nickel price environment. The currency, when I set the business up in 2001, the currency was 48 cents. And I can remember trying to get the financing loan in 2003. The currency was going to 56 and 57. I was waking up in the middle of the night and turning on Foxtel squawk box, and it was going to 60. I think, God, we won't be able to get the financing away. I couldn't have believed it would be 95 cents. And I went to a presentation the other day by an ANZ guy, and he's talking about $1.10, and I'm just about, you know, falling off my chair. But fundamentally, I think that, you know, obviously there are a lot of other things at play, but I think our currency did actually lag behind the commodity sector, and I think a lot of people expected our currency to be higher. There were other reasons, interest rate differentials and all those other things that come into play. But fundamentally, I'm hoping that the currency's peaked, and I think that if US interest rates start to go up and our interest rates start to go down, which I'm actually hearing that was mooted in the press this morning, then I think you'll see that interest rate differential drop, and hopefully the currency's peaked. But we have had to get used to much higher currencies, and as a result, that's had a massive impact on our business as well. Unfortunately for our business, you know, we're a price taker of nickel, and we're also a currency taker as well. We sell in US dollars, but all our costs are in Aussie dollars. So we have this fundamental problem that we're a small business, we're a taker. We can't influence that price too much unless we hedge, and our hedging up until the last few weeks has been a disaster. So I guess from a board perspective and a banking perspective, I've always struggled with the hedging side. Now that we have some cash in the bank, I think that what you can do is you can start using facilities like puts and actually pay some money out like insurance to actually buy the protection rather than doing these outright covers or very complicated option structures which always tend to blow you up. So we've become very conservative in the way that we run our, our hedging. And as a result, the hedging book is actually $40 million in the money, which is fantastic. Moving on to the challenges then, obviously cost is one of our enormous challenges as well. Wages are up, consumables are up, you know, obviously diesel's enormous increase. We have a diesel-fired power station in the Kimberley. We burn 16 million litres of diesel a year, and so obviously our costs there have doubled. So anything we can think of has gone up. I don't think anything has gone down. I've never seen an invoice that was lower than last month. I was talking to the accounts payable girl when she started our business 4 years ago. The cheques were about $300,000 a week. They're now $5 to $6 million a week as our business has grown and costs have gone up. But how do we manage those? And one of the things is, which is very counterintuitive, produce more nickel. You know, so that's going to flood the market and actually push the price further down. Now, we only produce, as I said, 1% of the world's nickel, so I doubt that another 1,000 tonnes of nickel is going to do that. But if everybody starts doing that and demand isn't as strong, then obviously you've got the same problem as any commodity cycle with too much production, weakened demand. So, you know, it all becomes sort of counterintuitive. But that's what we've been doing because that lowers your unit cost, and that's obviously one of the best ways to get your overall cost down and maintain your margin. Being clever. One of the things we're looking at in the Kimberley is hydropower. There's a huge dam 60 k's away from us. Argyle use hydro. Why can't we use hydro? If we've got a long life project, so it's an $80 or $90 million investment, but with diesel costs the way they are, that's something we should be seriously looking at. And even a business as small as ours probably has to really seriously consider something like that. Solar power, anything that we can actually do to get our power draw down. The big picture, we're always looking at things like, you know, just different ways of doing everything. And we spend probably 2 hours a week with a group of the senior guys in our business just workshopping different ideas of how we can cut costs. And we've been doing that for 4 or 5 years, and we'll continue to do that. You have to know all your costs. You know, one of the things is you just no surprises. And so we very, very close handle on what we're doing. We have a quarterly review where we look back on all the prices in our business and understand where all the costs are, so that when we write the quarterly report, like I was doing last night, you know, you don't get an awful shock at 5 to midnight when you're about to press the button to send to the ASX and all of a sudden your costs are up 30% and you can't explain it to the brokers because they're onto it straight away. And I actually looked at the BlackBerry just then, and there's already a couple of notes out about our quarterly and costs are up, and you know, is it going to continue and stuff like that? And I bet the share price is down on the back of it. So these things all impact you almost straight away, and they cause you many sleepless nights. But what you really have to do is empower your people, and that's what we've done. We've got a fantastic group of people, and I think if you empower them and give them and let them, you know, tell them what you want, keep them in the loop, then they're going to make sure your business is successful. Our most valuable asset is our people, and that's my people. That's my little team, three little guys, and my lovely wife. But you know, it's all about, you know, life is all about the family and the people around you. And we have a no dickheads policy in our company. We just don't want any, you know, because, you know, life's too short. As my old man says, you're only down here on holiday, you have to make the most of it. And so it's so important to go back to those guys and spend time with them. So how do we attract and retain key people? You've got to have culture. The culture is just so important. We've spent 7 years, you know, developing a culture which I think is a fantastic culture. I've worked in four other companies, and some of the cultures were good, some were bad, and I think we've created something which is very, very something that I cherish a lot. You've got to have a competitive salary. You can't pay people under the market. They just won't stay. But what you can do is give them other goodies. And we've been very, very successful. We have about a 20% turnover, which in our business I think is pretty good. I mean, some of our contractors run at over 100% per annum. We have cash bonuses, but we don't pay all the cash out in one hit. We sort of retain it and make sure people can see the next sort of 50% coming in 6 months' time. So you try and build up a bit of a brick system. We have medical benefits, we pay for that, which I think, you know, one of those things is once you close your own medical benefits and go onto someone else's, it's really so much paperwork to change over, it's almost not worth leaving the company to do it, so that's good. We pay a higher super, so if you've been with us for 2 years, you get 10%, and if you've been with us for 3 years, I think it goes up to 12%. And that's been a good thing as well. We've given a lot of people options, and a lot of people in our organisation have made a lot of money because the original options were at 70 cents, and I think we gave those out to about 150 people. And some of the people I know in the organisation have stayed with us, exercised their option, paid off their house, bought their kids a house with it, so that's been a fantastic thing. The options have got now almost too dilutive, and so our friends over on the East Coast, the superannuation funds, have voted those down. So we've gone for a new system of share rights, which seems to be working. However, the hurdles are higher and there's no guarantee the people will get them. But it's little things too. You know, every year you give them a pair of boots or something that, you know, just a bit different. And we've been doing a lot of that. And obviously the first and foremost is the safety culture. We have to have a good, you know, safe place to work. We've got to get everybody home safely every day. And then I get back to the cultural thing that's just so important for your business, and I can't stress just how important having a good culture and just enjoying going to work. So in conclusion, our business, we want to grow it, and we'll have to do that in a tougher commodity price environment going forward, with more production coming on and a slower world economy. But I think, you know, it is stronger for longer, and it is harder to get projects into development and into construction, so there's always a bit of a lag. Aussie dollar, I just hope it goes down. It's really giving me the shits at the moment, actually. Costs, you just have to watch and manage those. And as I said, you've really got to put a lot of effort into that. And especially now, we've been on a 4 or 5 year ramp up. Now you've just got to really watch those costs. And as I said, have good culture and reward people. And ultimately, we've got to have some fun.